Thank you for joining me. I am Brett Kelly, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fishery science. If you haven't already, please follow the podcast on Twitter at FisheriesPod or on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast. If you enjoy the show and would consider being a sponsor, please head over to patreon.com/fisheriespodcast. For as little as $1 a month, you can help out, make the show better, and receive a Fisheries Podcast sticker in the mail. For $10 a month, you'll receive a Fisheries Podcast hat along with the sticker and be the official sponsor of the final closing questions. And for $20 a month, you'll receive all the merch mentioned before, plus you'll be the official sponsor of each episode's guest or interview. But please remember, regardless of if you become a sponsor or not, we greatly appreciate you listening to the show. But as for today, I'll be speaking with Ben Martin, who is currently a PhD candidate at the Center for Limnology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and considers himself a food web ecologist with a fish-centric train of thought. He typically focuses on studying food webs and how they can be altered by disturbance. One disturbance in particular that he's interested in is the invasion of the spiny water flea to inland waters of Wisconsin. Part of his research is focused on how managers can manipulate native food webs to mitigate the invasion. His dissertation also covers a trophic cascade in a lake in northern Wisconsin caused by the stocking of lake trout for sport fishing opportunities. This cascade has been incredibly interesting to him and his research partners because the lake was also recently invaded by the spiny water flea. Overall, he strives to understand the two different food web configurations so that he can inform management of the lake's novel food web with the spiny water flea. And without further ado, welcome to the podcast, Ben.
Hey, thanks for having me, Brett.
So have you always been interested in the ecology of aquatic systems and food webs? So where did you cut your teeth on your interest in natural resources?
Yeah, so I did my undergraduate at Juniata College. It's a very small liberal arts school. There aren't any grad students there, so a lot of the research gets done by undergraduates. So the school is in Pennsylvania, so a lot more streams and reservoirs. So I started research my freshman year there, and I started doing all sorts of food web and fish interaction research in Pennsylvania, largely brook trout streams. That's largely where I began my research experience.
Nice. Well, it's always good to have a fellow brook trout researcher on the podcast. But the spiny water flea, let's just jump right into it. What is it and where is it from?
Yeah, so the spiny water flea is pretty interesting to me. So it's from Eurasia. It is a predatory zooplankton. It colonized the Great Lakes approximately in the 1980s. And the major feature of the spiny water flea is the sparved caudal tail. And the spiny water flea is very large. It's about the size of the width of your pinky. So very large, you can see it with the naked eye. And that barbed caudal spine makes it difficult for fish to consume them. So not only are they larger and faster than our native zooplankton, and therefore predate very heavily on them, but also native fish have a difficult time consuming them.
Oh yeah, no kidding. When I think of zooplankton, I definitely never think of something that I can see with the naked eye and as wide as my pinky. So what are you guys learning about its effects in Wisconsin, or particularly in your study area more specifically?
Yeah, so a lot of my research is focused on Lake Mendota, which is right here in downtown Madison. Lake Mendota receives a lot of nutrients from agricultural runoff. It's a eutrophic lake, so a lot of algae. Spiny water flea established in the lake in 2009. And since then, reduced Daphnia populations, so larger grazing zooplankton. They reduced their populations by about 90%. And that caused a reverse trophic cascade where we lost 3 feet of water clarity. And Lake Mendota didn't have much water clarity to lose. It was a very costly issue. And the aesthetics of the lake is a concern for many Madison folks, as many of them are water-oriented people. So there is much desire for sort of mitigation techniques of the spiny water flea. And that's where my research comes in. And it's largely had to been descriptive initially because we don't exactly know who's eating spiny water flea, when are they eating them. In the case of Mendota, it's suggested that the population size of spiny water flea in Mendota is the highest globally. So it's a very special case. And so initially it's been a lot of descriptive work, just looking through fish diets, using stable isotopes, some feeding trials as well, to really try and figure out who's eating them and to what extent.
That's interesting. So what are some of those mitigation strategies that you mentioned that would potentially work, and what are some other effective ways that you guys are going to potentially suggest that managers use?
Yeah, so initially, as before I came into the project and was mostly just reading about spiny water flea research, it was pretty doomsday that fish really, really struggle to eat them. Some will get aversion to them. But then my first samples that I took in the fall when I got here, the DNR gave me a bunch of yellow perch as they were doing sampling on the lake already. I was finding hundreds of thousands of spiny water flea and yellow perch. This was very surprising to me. And it seemed like they weren't having trouble consuming spiny water flea. So for the last year then, I've done food web snapshots essentially every 2 weeks starting in May through September to look at how much spiny water fleas are getting eaten by native fish. And I've consistently found a yellow perch specifically are consuming a large number of them. So then I also did feeding trials to physically see how well fish were able to consume spiny water flea. And I can still remember the first feeding trial I did. I was placed the spiny water flea in the tank with about 100 millimeter yellow perch, and it consumed it with no problem. It was the most uneventful feeding trial. I had read about them spitting these things out multiple times. And take 20 seconds for it to actually choke the spiny water flea down. In that initial trial, I fed a dozen spiny water flea to this fish, and not once did it have any problems. And that was consistent through the rest of my trials. I did about 80 fish, bluegills, yellow perch, largemouth bass, and very few fish in any circumstances ever spit the spiny water flea back out. So not only from the stomach contents have I been noticing fish are consuming spiny water flea, but then I've also verified with the feeding trials that they seem to be able to do it pretty easily.
Well, at least that's pretty promising that the native species can tolerate, you know, feeding on spiny water fleas. Has there been any interest in potentially supplemental stockings of yellow perch, or is it somewhat hands-off until the results of your study come out?
Yeah, so we're definitely holding off a bit till I have things further verified. But the food web in Lake Mendota is interesting in the way that it's been manipulated before, actually. In the 1990s, work from the Steve Carpenter trophic cascade experiments up in northern Wisconsin, up in the UP, they were showing that stocking of piscivores can improve water clarity by causing a trophic cascade. And so they did that on Lake Mendota in the 1990s through the early 2000s, where they were stocking a lot of walleye and pike to try and reduce the planktivore populations. And this was successful. It did improve water clarity, and things were all good. But then the explosion of spiny water flea in 2009 has reversed that cascade. And so when thinking about it, we essentially right now, we still have a lot of walleye and pike. We've still been stocking as we were in the 1990s and early 2000s. But we have very few yellow perch in the lake. And so what's sort of coming out of my work is starting to suggest that maybe we have pretty much the exact wrong configuration for the food web if we want to prioritize water clarity. And that's definitely a pretty big if. As we all know, as fisheries managers, there's a lot of stakeholders. So right now there are a lot of people who love fishing for walleye and pike on Mendota. It's a good fishery. And so if you wanted to prioritize water clarity, likely we'd have to get rid of that in order to allow the yellow perch population to grow and potentially mitigate spiny water flea.
So it definitely sounds like you have some interesting management implications, and it'll be interesting to see how different stakeholder groups are targeted or pleased or unsatisfied. But you mentioned the introduction of spiny water flea into Lake Mendota. But are there other water bodies around Wisconsin that it also has had negative effects on?
Spiny water flea are in about a dozen lakes in Wisconsin. There's a hot spot up in northern Wisconsin, up around Vilas County. that suggests that they're likely being passed around through boater traffic. These lakes are very, very close together. A lot of people do recreate on multiple lakes. But the situation up there is a little different because the waters are much colder. They're not as productive. Mendota just has a large amount of energy at the base of the food web because of all those nutrients coming from agriculture. So to begin with, Mendota had a ton of Daphnia. It was a very large Daphnia population. And so that gave Spiny Water Flea this massive food base to become such a big issue. But up in the northern lakes, we see much lower densities in those lakes. And as far as studying the effects, if they've actually had a negative effect on those lakes, they haven't been studied as well up there. And so my research, as you mentioned, the lake trout stocking trophic cascade project I'm working on, initially what I was interested in that was because of spiny water flea. And how that sort of came about was spiny water flea got into a trout lake in 2014. And since then, I wanted to know whether or not water clarity has changed similar to Lake Mendota. And what I found was around 2010, there was this massive peak in water clarity. And so it wasn't a spiny water flea thing because they weren't even there yet. And so I was trying to figure out what was going on in the food web that it was about a meter and a half of water clarity increase around between 2006 and 2014. What I ended up finding was that this lake trout population became very large. The cisco, the prey of lake trout, their populations were reduced. And so that allowed water clarity to return because there were more Daphnia that weren't getting eaten by cisco.
So the stocking of lake trout changed that food web, but are lake trout native to some of the waters of Wisconsin for people that might not be familiar with waters of the Midwest?
Yeah, so lake trout are native. They're still in several lakes up in the Northwoods, as we call it. So Trout Lake, interestingly, has a unique genetic strain of lake trout. And so they've been stocking lake trout in Trout Lake for at least 50 years, I believe, and a fair amount of them. However, the genetic strain was coming from largely Lake Superior strain lake trout. And I believe it was around 2003, there was a paper that they found out that the genetic strain of Trout Lake's lake trout are unique. And so they started stocking those genetic strain. We aren't 100% positive, but it is sort of believed that that is probably what allowed the population to grow so much and sort of peak around 2010 that coincided with this water clarity change.
Okay, so that's interesting. Now you have a whole nother component to the story that makes it a little bit even more complicated. So what year did you say that spiny water flea were introduced via most likely boat traffic to Trout Lake?
Yeah, so 2014 was when we first found them. Now we do know spiny water flea, like many invasives, lie at low levels for a while, usually below detection. So this has been studied in the Minnesota lakes. They're trying to figure out how long have spiny water flea been there before they sort of exploded. In the case of Lake Mendota, Jake Walsh, who was a previous grad student in our lab, was studying spiny water flea in Mendota, and he found through sediment cores, looking for the tails of the spiny water flea, that they had been here since around the 1990s. And so that begs the question, why did they explode in 2009? And it's quite interesting there because it was a climactic anomaly in 2008, where it was a very cool summer. And so that cool summer didn't kill off the resting eggs in the sediment. And so in 2009, there was just a lot more viable eggs in the sediment that it allowed the population of spiny water flea to reach sizable abundances where we were finally getting them in our zooplankton tows. And so something interesting there is just that Lake Mendota, we call the most studied lake in the world. It's sort of some of the founding limnology work was done on it. And so right now there's, in the 1990s, there's been an NSF-funded project, long-term ecological research. And so zooplankton tows are taken at least monthly on the lake since the 90s. So it's pretty interesting that it took until 2009 for us to even find one. So the first time they were found was by a limnology class as they were taking toes for the class. And my advisor noticed the spiny water flea, had heard of it, and confirmed that the lake is now infested with them.
Wow, I wish I could say that I was part of as famous of a lab group as that. But yeah, I definitely think that when you think of UW-Madison, it's almost synonymous with, you know, limnological research. So that is some pretty cool stuff. Definitely be on the lookout for your work. When do you think, everyone probably hates this question, but when do you think some of that dissertation research will be available to the public or potentially in publication form?
Yeah, so I'm hoping to have my first chapter, which is on the trophic cascade in Trout Lake. I'm hoping to have that submitted here probably in the fall, September. We'll see with the whole pandemic right now. Things are changing. but yeah, probably have that. The food web in Lake Mendota work, I'm doing a lot of isotope sampling. So currently I'm a little backlogged on that. UC Davis, where we have our isotopes analyzed, is just opening back up, but I'm not able to get into my lab to send those yet. And I imagine Davis is probably going to be backlogged as far as analyzing those samples for a bit. So I'm going to be a little limited there. So probably sometime next spring.
Yeah, definitely a lot of unique challenges associated with labs closing down and access to doing research. So hopefully everything goes smoothly for you in the upcoming future.
Luckily, I've had enough virtual work to work on.
Yeah, right. So moving on to something else that is definitely a big part of your work, it's regarding your outreach and your science communication. Digging around on your website, you know, you can find Tiny the Spiny and some other unique things that you've done. Can you touch on why outreach is important to you?
Yeah, so this sort of goes back to sort of this distrust for science that many of us talk about. And this is my sort of approach to try and break down that distrust for science. And so to me, I think one of the best ways is to be very open about your science and give people the opportunity to see inside your scientific work in order to see, you know, how does something get to publication? And so I really want to be able to allow people to see into my science and why I should be trusted as a scientist. So that's sort of how I approach that whole distrust for science thing.
That's great. Yeah. I work with private landowners mostly during my master's research. And one of the main things that I tried to do at the end of the project was provide any landowners that I sampled on their property with a detailed report of what we found there and what we did while we were there, include a couple of pictures, because I really want to drive the message home that we truly were just looking for different fish populations and we just wanted to do some fish sampling. We weren't trying to, you know, sample water quality so that we could report back to agency 1, 2, 3 or anything like that. And I think it made a noticeable impression on some people. I mean, obviously some weren't available, and so I just dropped it off in a mailbox or something like that. But I think trying to be as transparent as possible is something that moving forward we're definitely going to have to do if we want to have substantial standing in society. So I think it's awesome. I also love the Twitter handle for information about the spiny water flea. I think that's pretty funny. What are some other things that you or lab mates have done in regards to outreach for your research?
Yeah, so I think our Center for Limnology department does a really good job of this outreach and trying to be transparent. And that's what did attract me to come into this this university. And one of those things, probably my favorite thing probably for outreach all year, is our open houses. So we have an open house at our Hasler lab here in Madison. And then we also have an open house up in the Northwoods, up in Vilas County at our field station. And so this is one day over the summer. We have ice cream. We have all sorts of stations. There's zooplankton tows going on, macroinvertebrate identification. We have fish in tanks. Grad students usually have little displays of their research. So I have all sorts of spiny water flea stuff. And so it's an opportunity for us, especially to not only get kids out and see what we're doing, but also have their parents sort of hanging around and lingering and seeing, you know, what is it that is being done on Lake Mendota. So I can talk about spiny water flea, why they're problematic. Another lab mate can talk about zebra mussels in the lake and why it's important to wash your boats. And so I think that's really one of the best cases where we use outreach to be transparent about our science and hopefully gain the trust of the community that enjoys the resource we're trying to study.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I like that you mentioned that having kids, but also kids and their parents sort of hang around. One of the most memorable parts of my research was being able to sample with an entire family on their property and show them that there was a natural reproduction of brown trout that sort of blew their mind. They wouldn't have ever thought that right beside where they have picnics and whatnot, right in the stream, that there could be, you know, life and natural reproduction of like a cold water fish like that. And actually, in a follow-up email, that person said that one of their sons actually said to him that he wanted to be a fish biologist when he grew up. And so I was like, well, that's sort of the coolest thing that I've heard throughout this whole field season. So I think that's really cool what you guys have with that field day. That sounds pretty unique. Also on your website, I couldn't help but snoop around, as people do, on some of the previous publications that you put out, and notice that you have a pretty wide variety of work that you've done, everything from crabs and brook trout, which is, I guess, atypical but super cool. Could you describe a memory or project that stands out as your favorite or something that you sort of hang your hat on?
Yeah, so I guess it would definitely be that fiddler crab stuff. So that originates from a class here at for the Center for Limnology for grad students. When you first come in, there's been this long tradition, I think 40 years maybe, of this what's called Sapelo Island trip. So it's a class, and what it is we go down there for about 10 days. We design research projects before we go. Those research projects, however, cannot be on sort of our pet organisms that we usually study. So I couldn't go down there and touch a fish. I couldn't do morphometrics on anything. So it pushes us, and we also have no research funds. So there's a offsite facility that has just a bunch of research junk. So you go there, scrap whatever you can, chicken wire, calipers, like that level of science. We go down there for 10 days and you try and carry out your projects. And often things do get published from work that is done there. And it's supposed to sort of be this mesocosm of problem solving that you'll have to do at some point throughout your graduate education. Yeah, so I wanted to work on fiddler crabs. They're these crabs with a enlarged claw that is about 40% of their body weight. So the first project I worked on there was looking at the fiddler crab as it autotomizes its claw, so it can amputate its claw. And so I wanted to know, wow, this claw is 40% of its body weight. It can amputate it. Will it run faster without that claw? And so I did these paired designs. I ran the crab several times before I took their claw off, and then I took their claw off, had them run again, and I found them to be 30% faster without their claw. And it was interesting because I wasn't the first person to ask that question. However, there were three or four other studies that found insignificant results, that they didn't improve the running speed. And those studies had some flaws potentially in the way that they were, their housing conditions for the crabs, how many times were they running them with how much rest in between. So that was sort of my first project. And then the second project, I took the length of the body and the claw of over 400 fiddler crabs and recorded which hand the enlarged claw was. And I wanted to ask the question of whether or not there is a biometric difference between lefties and righties. And lefties and righties tend to be about 50% even split in the population. I ended up finding that the population was slightly right-hand biased, so there were more right-handed individuals. But right-handed crabs actually had a smaller claw proportional to their body, which is about the opposite of what I would have expected. And so then I was able to go back, since this class has been going on for 40 years, and look at what other people have done on fiddler crabs. And I found sometime around 2002, Peter Johnson had worked on fiddler crabs on this same trip. And he had found that there were more left-handed severed claws in the marsh. And so this class is pretty cool because you can go down there, go study something you've never seen before, and sort of rely on these previous researchers that have gone down there also at a similar time, this early graduate career stage. And so it's just a sort of a really, really cool opportunity.
Yeah, that sounds, one, fun, and two, and just really invaluable to learning, you know, the true scientific process that, you know, stands off of a page a little bit more than that diagram of the scientific method that we've all seen in a textbook or something. So that is really cool. I wish definitely more programs would implement something like that.
Yeah, the trip is a blast. It's definitely the highlight of what I've done so far here at UW.
Yeah, so where is Sapelo Island?
It's down in Georgia. So part of the tradition is you have to drive down there for Madison. Drive through the night, you very little sleep. For my car, it was only me and one other person splitting the driving. So you drive all the way down there. You're kind of tired. You take a little shuttle boat onto this other island. You have to go study these things you don't really know. It's hot, buggy, it's muddy. Yeah, so, but I say it's fun. I genuinely really enjoyed the trip.
So when Ben isn't studying food webs or communicating science to the public, what do you do for fun? What do you like to do?
So probably not surprisingly, I like to fish. That's what got me interested in this initially. I fished bass tournaments growing up. It always made me think so much from a research mind that, you know, why was that fish there? And why is this pattern working right now? And so I'm fortunate to be able to study that in a more formal setting. But yeah, so definitely a lot of fishing, a lot of disc golf. I got into disc golf about a year ago. So really enjoyed that. Madison has several courses. Also homebrewing beer, big into homebrewing beer, recipe developing. One of my friends from undergrad, we started a homebrewing club on our undergraduate campus. And it turns out he's now a brewer at a brewery that they opened in our undergraduate town. I respond with him a lot about recipes, and it definitely take a lot of enjoyment from that.
That's neat. Well, tell him not to forget about you whenever he's, you know, up at Budweiser or something, thinking of new recipes for crafts.
They were actually going to provide kegs for the Pennsylvania American Fisheries Society meeting, but I think COVID kind of messed that up. But
yeah, what hasn't it? Well, that's cool. I don't know what the policies on shipping liquids are, but if you could sell that stuff, I definitely would take some.
Yeah, I think technically it's illegal, but you can send what's, quote, yeast samples. Technically, I don't filter the yeast out of them. I guess you consider them yeast samples, but yeah.
Well, I guess the difficult part of the interview is now over. We won't grill you about your research and all the potential impacts and everything like that. But we would like to close out the episode with a couple of questions that we ask each of our guests. And the number one question, first and foremost, every time, what is your favorite fish?
So I'm always follow that up with, are you asking to research or to fish for?
Ooh, this is the first time we've had a rebuttal. I love this. I would say your favorite fish that exists just for the intrinsic value of it being there.
Okay, so it would definitely be the Ciscos of the Great Lakes. The adaptive radiation with them and, you know, being called the Darwin's Finches of the Great Lakes. Those will actually be the topic of my later chapters. I'm just starting to work on those. But I just think they're so fascinating. I do really take an interest in evolution. So from that standpoint, I think the Ciscos and the entire species flock is just incredible to me.
Awesome. That's a very detailed answer. Most of the time, it's bluegill. I gotta say, if I were keeping stats, I mean, that's shooting from the hip. But if I were keeping stats, I would assume bluegills are number one. Everyone loves to fish for them. They're good stuff.
I like eating them, but
absolutely.
I don't know if they're that interesting. I guess behaviorally, they got some cool things going on.
Yeah. So what is your dream job or location once you finish your PhD?
Yeah, so I think I could see myself staying in academia. I do really love teaching. I guess we didn't talk much about that, but I really do enjoy teaching. Here at UW, I teach the Ecology of Fishes class. Super, super fun class to teach. So I would like to be able to do some teaching, but also definitely just research and applied fisheries questions. So yeah, I could see myself staying in academia, but also some sort of co-op or something I could see myself fitting into.
Oh yeah, we have the co-op unit at Iowa State, and we had one at Clemson where I did my undergrad. And I always thought it was neat how they incorporated into, you know, teaching a few classes yet doing research and advising students. So I think that's a great partnership that they have. But so you mentioned teaching and really liking to teach. What are some classes that you've taught, and have they been lab oriented or mostly lectures?
Yeah, so the Ecology of Fishes classes, there is a lecture that my advisor Jake Van Der Zanden and John Lyons teach, and then the lab class is taught by TAs. So myself and one other person was teaching that the last 2 years. And so, yeah, it's a lab-based class. It's unfortunately the only fish class at UW. And so it's very broad. We cover taxonomy as well as ecology. We usually have a short 30, 45 minute lecture, and then lab activities. And then in my undergrad, I helped teach a couple labs, freshman bio labs. So the ecology module of freshman bio lab, and then a fish toxicology module of the second semester freshman biology lab.
Very cool. Yeah, when I was my first year during my master's, I taught the general intro to biodiversity biology class here at Iowa State. And, you know, it's a challenge because you have students ranging from computer science to, you know, bio majors, but they might be there to study human bodies and things like that. So trying to make it relevant for people that come from different backgrounds and have different areas of study was definitely a challenge, but I thought it was a good experience. So
Yeah, it's definitely good to know why your students are in the class. That's one of the first day that we do the note card activity and try and lay that out so we know how we can best serve when we're teaching.
So if there was one point or principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head that listened to this episode, one lasting impression from your interview, what would you say that is?
I would say that it's the opportunities invasive species can give us from a research standpoint. Obviously, I'm not for the spread of invasive species. I don't know who is, but from a food web ecology, sort of disturbance ecology standpoint, invasive species give you a really nice gradient to study disturbance and a very definable timeline to ask those questions. So I would say, you know, take an interest in studying invasive species, not only from sort of a basic science standpoint, you know, asking about trophic cascades, but because it's an invasive species, there's also an applied issue at hand there. So any information you can provide to improve invasive species mitigation definitely improves our ability to mitigate them.
Sure. Yeah, they're definitely not going away, and they're going to be a management challenge into the future. So I mean, that's a unique perspective, because typically people might hate them. Obviously, like you said, they can cause a lot of damage or a lot of, you know, ecological chaos, but you point out that they do provide a pretty unique opportunity to study what those disturbances do to the natural ecology, if you will, of those systems. So thank you for tuning in to today's episode. I want to first and foremost thank Ben for coming on to the show. I learned a ton. I didn't even know what a spiny water flea or how big they were before today. So I'd like to just thank you for being a guest on today's show.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks for having me. It was really fun.
And I want to remind everyone at home about the Patreon page. If you like this episode or you like the show and you feel inclined to help us out in some way, you can head over to patreon.com/fisheriespodcast. to become a sponsor or get some cool fish pod merch. If you'd like to get a hold of us, you can find us on Twitter at the handle fisheriespod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or old fashioned email feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. Don't forget, you can download and subscribe to receive future notifications about episodes on your favorite listening app, or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. I'm Brett Kelly, and thank you for listening to the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, invasive species may be damaging, but they provide unique research opportunities.